You're listening to SageCast, the podcast of Pomona College, where we talk with faculty and alumni who are making a difference on campus and beyond. I'm Travis Ketchatorian.
And I'm Marilyn Thompson. This season, we're talking with SageHens who are tackling the difficult in the world. And today's guest, Michael Sakura, Pomona class of 1973, certainly is doing just that.
After a long career in emergency medicine, Dr. Sakura became public health officer of San Bernardino County in Southern California in November of 2020, just as COVID-19 vaccines were about to become available.
Dr. Sakura soon learned that public health is where medicine meets politics. We sat down with him in the studios of KSPC to talk about his experiences in the age of COVID, fentanyl, and other public health challenges. Here's that conversation.
Michael, welcome to SageCast.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your pathway to Pomona.
Well, it's actually amazing how I got to Pomona. I'm an immigrant son. I came to the U.S. when I was 5 years old. We were born in Hong Kong, and my parents had to scrap the money to actually, they got a sudden permission to immigrate after many years. My dad and mom came over when I was 5 years old, and my dad was 44, my mom was 47, with five children, with no job assured, into the U.S. And so we did it for us, for our education. And so we kind of put our nose to the grindstone, as first generation children do.
So how did you get to Pomona?
Well, good story. I played football in high school, uh-huh. And I was a decent football player, but nothing more. But in terms of my college choices, I was going to one other school other than it wasn't Pomona. And my high school football coach came and said, he kind of took me aside, and he was at lunch hour, and he said, "Sakura, I think you can play college football." And I said, "Coach, look at me. You can't see me on this SageCast, but I'm, it was 5'5 at the time, 145 pounds. And I said, "Coach, come on, look at me." And he goes, "No, I got a friend. His name's Walt Ambrose, and he was a football coach at Pomona College. And he knew I was the valedictorian in my class. It basically put me on track to come to Pomona.
When did you know you wanted to be pre-med?
The high achieving students kind of in general, as a default, frequently pick pre-med. And the half of the football team were pre-med, so I ended up going pre-med. But that led me to, such professors like R. Nelson Smith, and Dr. Hanch for organic, and Dr. Lyman Benson, they were towering intellects who wrote their own textbooks, and they basically took an interest in me. And I was like, wow, I'm just this little immigrant kid without much of a background. And, they took an interest. Open office hours and mentoring me, and it was teaching me how to think. And it just completely opened me up. I still remember coming there. I was kind of high school valedictorian, but probably half my class were valedictorians from their school. So it was kind of eye-opening. And I kind of, walking home one day, noticed, at about 2 a.m., walking home from the library, and I looked up at the dorm, and, three-quarters of the lights were on, and people are all studying still. And I'm saying, I think this is going to be a challenge.
I would imagine it was a little bit more than being a valedictorian that drove you into the health profession. Was there a drive to want to work in hospitals?
Yeah, there actually was. Thanks. And it's part of that drive that led to me where I am now in public health. I really wanted to pay it back. I loved the concept of service and being able to help people, but at the same time, be really well respected and be assured of a good life. So,
is there anything that's different today about critical care medicine than when you first started?
Oh yeah, it's completely different now.
What's different?
Well, it's so much more technologic, the science and. And we now know it as AI, but we know progressive evidence basis for progress has led basically to logarithmic jumps in technology and what we and the way we approach things.
So does that help in diagnosis?
It absolutely does. And you know, the emergency medicine was when I took it on, it was a new specialty, and I basically chose it. I've always kind of wanted to. I liked it. Basically trailblaze a little bit. And so I chose emergency medicine because it had immediate gratification and I could save lives immediately. But a lot of it was, we were learning what we were doing. And then as it became a specialty, emergency medicine, then developed training programs, research programs, and worked more and more with internal medicine and ICU medicine. And so it's became a lot more academic, a lot more evidence-based. So
I'm hoping you could take us into the room of an ER facility. What is it like on a day-to-day basis when you're kind of dealing with patients on their worst days?
Yeah, it's controlled chaos. It's amazing because you basically have to be able to multitask every minute you're there, because even from the time you come on, you take sign off, and there could very well be 2, 3, 4 critical patients with 3 ambulances in the bay and 10 people checking in, and we basically have to triage these people and these patients in terms of by severity of illness. But also what's happened in emergency medicine is we learned the service portion, so we had to move them through quickly. Because people don't like to go to the ER and sit 6 hours, even though they do. So you basically have to learn to triage, and we developed pretty sophisticated mechanisms of screening patients so that we can screen the quick people with the ankle sprains and the sore throats that we could quickly get in and out, and then take care of the critically ill ones, and then kind of order up the lab tests. So.
Is there any case that you think of that just sticks with you in your mind?
There are a lot.
So but, one in particular that you'll never forget?
It sounds gruesome, but we had one of our medical school professors who came in. He had been attacked on the street, and he basically came in with an ice pick in his eye.
And
having to deal with someone you knew and respected and who was in critical shape like that, it kind of broke through that objectivity. You know, in medicine, you have to create a veneer of objectivity to be able to function correctly. Because if you get subjective, if you think about emotions and reactions, it really kind of screws you up. So that's the kind of thing that. It stopped us all in our tracks, but fortunately we're conditioned enough to be able to do that. And but trauma, trauma is creates so many interesting cocktail stories.
Oh, is he okay?
Huh? He is. He lost significant vision in his eye, of course.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
but he made it.
He made it.
Wow!
Made it.
Now you became a leader in medicine. In the state of California in San Bernardino County. Tell us about that.
Oh, thank you. So when I came from Portland, that's where I did my residency trainings. I came back down with my parents were getting older, so I wanted to come back to Southern California. So I took over a directorship of an ER in Redlands, California, just not too far from Claremont. And then progressively, I joined this physician partnership that basically staffed multiple emergency departments. And so I was basically given more and more ERs to oversee. So I eventually oversaw 12 different ERs in the area, including the one local to here, Pomona Valley. And during that time, I got into organized medicine as well. I became the national risk director for Vituity Medical Group. And basically, one of my jobs was keep everyone out of trouble, and we had this pandemic hitting us. And so my job was to keep track of all the new evidence that was coming in about COVID. And so I was close to actually retiring at the time. And so I was approached at that point, late 2019, to become the health officer for San Bernardino County.
So you would have been going from the practice of medicine and supervising doctors to running a public health entity as the medical officer?
Yeah, as the health officer.
Health officer
for the San Bernardino Department of Public Health. Yeah.
With how many people on your team?
It initially was 900, and when COVID hit, we had to hire all these contact tracers and disease investigators, and it swelled to over 1,500.
Wow. What's the range of services that you oversee now in that capacity?
Well, public health has to, it's big time surveillance and investigation and disease control. So we oversee all of the communicable disease emergencies, and from COVID to syphilis to TB to HIV to hepatitis C. Public health also oversees other related things like environmental health, which gives you your restaurant grades, your ABCs. That's public health that does that. Water and surveillance, and so it's a huge spectrum. Animal control is even under public health. So it's.
I remember as working as a journalist, public health departments, they were important, but they kind of lived on the periphery of what was going on in the zeitgeist. Suddenly, they were thrust in front and center. Was that a jolt to you to be the public face of public health during a global pandemic?
It was a jolt for public health for sure. And you know, talk about being on your heels and then having to respond to probably the largest public health challenge in history. That's what public health had to do, and it blew away the previous health officer, and that's why they needed help. And so I had worked with the medical society, and I'd worked with all the hospitals, and I knew the data. So they approached me, and so but I'll tell you, Travis, talk about eye opening. When I came in, I had to learn how to be a public health officer and learn public health and keep track of what's going on in all the hospitals that were completely overrun with COVID patients and a sense of anxiety and panic throughout our society. So it's
this was 8 months after the start of the pandemic in the U.S.
Yes, and every one of our hospitals in San Bernardino County were full. We had patients in our hallways, in our cafeterias, and in our gift shops. And
oh my goodness!
We had people dying right and left, including the doctors and nurses. And so we had to learn how to control this thing. And we had to simultaneously learn what COVID does, learn what the disease was, and how to treat it, and learn actually how does it spread. How do we even test? We had no tests. We went through 3 months without a good test for COVID. So we had to do what we call syndromic surveillance. Oh, it looks like it. You know, it's a flu-like syndrome where you lose your smell and taste. And so that's COVID. So, but the CDC kind of tripped up in giving us a good, reliable, test that we could just spread throughout, throughout the community. So we had to fly by the seat of our pants. And so that's why you see a lot of things with Dr. Fauci and the politicians basically jumping all over him. Well, he changed his mind. You know, for one time he says wear masks and other times don't. Well, as the evidence grew, as we learned more about the disease and how it spread, we had to change and we had to. You know, and there was one point where
Learning curve.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was so bad, we just needed time. And you remember that flattening the curve?
Mm-hmm.
That we needed time to learn about this disease and gather ourselves. That was why there was the lockdown. We had to just everyone stop. And the world is being threatened. We need to just stop and really learn how to do this. And we have to learn how to develop that vaccine, and we made amazing progress, but it was quite a ride.
You came into your new job right when the vaccine rollout was getting organized. Tell us about what that was like. You were in a county that San Bernardino County is the biggest by geography county in the whole country, all the way from the Arizona border over to Montclair.
Yeah,
I think in right on the edge of LA County, that's a huge area. And then you've got a vaccine that has to be kept super cold in a lot of cases, ramped up for a lot of people. How'd you do that?
It was really tough. And you know, the what we learn in public health is there's what we call the social determinants of health. And the social determinants of health basically are things like access to medical care, education, transportation, and food, food security, et cetera. And so when you have a huge county, like the largest county in the country, 21,000 square feet, square miles, you know, we had to get this out. And the populations, the vulnerable populations, the elderly, the immunosuppressed, but also the people who didn't have the income, didn't have transportation and access to medical care, they were disproportionately hit with COVID. So we had to go out and get them. So we had this new vaccine, and it started with a tremendous scarcity. So we had to develop all these criteria of who needs it most and the most needy first. And so we've actually spread this out, and we just used it up. But then down the line, you know, as we're using it up, we're looking, where else do we need to go in terms of, you know, our high needy population, our elderly, our homebound, our African-American population, our Latinx population, our Native Hawaiian Pacific Islanders. So we really had to get out there. So we had to not only get through cultural barriers, but we had to get through geographic barriers. So we had to, we have this system of called MPODs, which we could go through Needles or Trona or way out there in the depths of our county. And we developed a mobile team, multiple mobile teams to go out and not only test and teach, but also to vaccinate. So.
Now, you also mentioned that it was really important to rebuild trust.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
This was a tough time, as we all know. But, you know, public health is just kind of defined as where medicine meets politics, right? Mm-hmm. So politics, it couldn't have been worse in that. It was a perfect storm for politics. And we had a president who basically started by when being asked how to control all these increasing cases, he responded, "Stop testing," and he denied that there was that COVID was even a disease. And it got to where it was, why should our people have to choose between to vaccinate or test or not? Based on your politics, does it make sense at all? And so what happened was when politics gets in the middle, you get the concept our Surgeon General called it misinformation. We had this epidemic of misinformation where things were thrown out like COVID is a hoax, and the vaccine causes genetic mutations, and so we had to just battle. Not only do we have to battle the disease now, we had to battle this whole epidemic of lies and misinformation. And so people started doubting doctors. And so that's where the trust is. We had to build that trust back up, and we had to educate, and based on education and things that people could actually see and ground their knowledge and their beliefs on, to where they could start to believe us again. So it was really difficult. We had to build, when people are in a situation of life or death, they have to trust who's leading them through that sea. And so we had to get them back. So,
did that change you and your relationship with medicine and your relationship with patients?
It changed me, Travis. Yeah, it actually did, because I hadn't realized how much we needed to rely on other people. You know, as a critical care physician, I knew I had the skills to save a life one-on-one when that patient came one-on-one. But in this situation, I couldn't do that. I had to work through groups. I had to work through community-based organizations, faith-based groups. I had to be the conduit from the CDC and the CDPH to bring those truths and actually convert and gain the trust of those people. So it really changed me. It opened me up in that way. It was traumatic too, but I think I was blessed at least with the ability to absorb trauma, and so I was able to assimilate that, but it was very stressful.
Do you think there's any way to depoliticize public health today?
No.
Really?
Yeah. Partially because, you know, if you put yourself in a situation where you see a potential public health crisis. And I have, if I see an epidemic of dengue fever coming or whatever, I've got to be able to shut that business down and isolate that everyone involved, quarantine the ones who might be. And to do that, you need basically to go through and get to the businesses, get pass the policies, pass a law to be able to do that. So we are at the interface where, you know, the things we do affect businesses, affect schools, and it's all political in that regard. So
one of the things that we're seeing today is that there are some new laws that are being passed or suggested in a number of states that would reduce public health authority in those kind of circumstances. Does that worry you?
Well, it does worry me as long as it's but as long as it's couched in a regular progression where the problem is people who are not physicians should not be making medical decisions. That's a big thing. But if the law actually entails the actual implementation of medical orders in conjunction or in partnership with physicians and with medical care, then I think it's okay. Because docs and doctors, you know, we don't know the mechanisms of how to get this done from a business standpoint. You know, we can tell you what needs to be done. But so there needs to be a partnership. It needs to be, you need to work together in groups. And so it's a little bothersome, but that's why we need, and I was involved with the Medical Society, this California Medical Association, the AMA, that's, and now we have the Health Officers Association and the CCLHO. So we need to basically work together to inform our Congress people who are voting on those laws, and so that they make informed decisions. And so it's scary, but it's actually just extra incentive to stay involved from an advocacy standpoint. And that's probably why I got involved with our state organization as well. So I'm on the board now of the California Coalition of Local Health Officers, and just because I realized the need for doing that.
I want to change gears just real quickly. So my dad was a firefighter paramedic back in the 1980s in LA City. And one of the things that he mentioned is that over the course of his decades-long career is that his job changed in a certain way to become more about pain management. And I was curious from your perspective, because he'd bring them to the ER, mm-hmm. if that was the same situation that you saw change over the course of your career as well.
Yeah. Your dad pointed out a really important and actually potentially tragic a turn that acute care medicine took, and that was the emphasis on pain. And the fact that part of our job was just to eliminate pain. And and that was pushed at the same time. Certain pharmaceutical companies were saying, we've got the great drugs for you to eliminate pain. And so we pushed that. And pain became the fifth vital sign. And you know, besides blood pressure, pulse, heart rate, oxygen saturation, the fifth vital sign was pain. And so, yeah, great point. And we
so
got
it. So what made it so bad, the opioid crisis, now fentanyl? Were there factors that, beyond the management of pain, that made it so bad in the country today?
Yeah, the drugs themselves. And you'll know, we basically, the drug companies developed these long-acting pain medicines that gave you basically a prolonged high, were highly addictive. And so the opioid crisis has three phases. The first was prescription. You know, the doctors overprescribed pain medications, and there was these pain meds like OxyContin and which was the big one, that were sold, initially developed for cancer pain, but were told, oh, it's great for chronic pain. And so we overprescribed. There were no prescription guidelines. And so all the leftover opioids were picked up by children, the children of those people who had those extra opioids. And so it basically fed on an opioid addiction or use disorder. And then heroin came in to replace that because people couldn't get the OxyContin. And so heroin took off. And then what happened after heroin, of course, they learned about fentanyl. which is 50 times stronger, so they could use 50 times less drug, and they could feed it into almost everything, pills, Xanny bars, they call them. There's Xanax bars, any pill, so that we're in our third phase now of fentanyl, or illegally manufactured fentanyls, that are basically killing innocent young people, and including college students, high school students, who are basically just experimenting. They're just taking one OxyContin pill because they were told you can get high with it. But no, it's not OxyContin. It's fentanyl, and it's killing people.
How scary is fentanyl, since you've seen it come in a wave of popularity or unknown in the drugs that people are taking?
It's really scary, Travis, because it almost, if you look at, if you just take out a salt shaker and take out 12 granules of salt, it's that much fentanyl that can kill someone who doesn't have a tolerance. So they're putting it in everything. And the problem is it's not controlled right by the FDA. So one pill may have barely anything, and another pill can kill two people. So and it's being sold on the street. So it's the FDA completely has lost control of not to put down their efforts. They're trying as hard as they can, but it's just that it's just everywhere. And so now we have this new legion of victims, these kids who are not addicted to opioids, who are just basically doing what we all did, experimenting. We used to drink our parents' whiskey, from the liquor cabinets or whatever. But they're experimenting now, and not even realizing it, and they're dying. So what we've got to do now is get the word out that anything that you buy illegally or not manufactured could have fentanyl in it, could kill you. And we're trying to get what we call harm reduction out there, which is Narcan, which is the antidote that just with a nasal sniffer basically can reverse and save a life. So that's what we're doing now.
What kinds of programs are people involved in public health promoting to address the opioid crisis, the fentanyl crisis?
As you can imagine, as pervasive as this is and as unpredictable of where it will hit, we've got to get it out there everywhere. So what we're working with the schools, we're working with all of our community-based organizations, we're basically getting the concept of harm reduction, because harm reduction is basically, it's destigmatizing drug use, because if you tell kids, you need to come and get Narcan if you're going to use drugs, right? A good kid, even a sagehand kid, is not going to go up and say, "I'm going to use narcotics." No, they're not going to. So you have to destigmatize it. You have to open it up and make it available. The other thing is what we're doing is we developed this database. It's a hotspot identifier. It looks at all of our overdoses, and we're looking. It's based on that Pareto principle, but we're looking at our hotspots, and we're sending out teams of harm reduction to areas that suddenly have four or five overdoses. So we're getting Narcan out there, and harm reduction education out there as well. So we've got every organization that we can that wants to participate, hopefully the Claremont College in Pomona has it available, and if not, I'm here.
So, are you seeing progress?
Yeah, I think it is. I think we are, but it's still too early to tell. We're still, last year the number one cause of mortality in the age group 14 to 17 in our county was fentanyl. 14 to 17 it's scary. But we're making progress, and unfortunately our data is we're trying to get real time data to be able to respond as quickly as possible, but mm-hmm. It's difficult.
So I'm curious, after it's been quite a long few years from a public health perspective, is public health your future, or are you set in the emergency room? Where do you prefer to be?
No, actually, I'm now a health officer. Public health is my future now. It's actually, I'm not a young man anymore either. So as you knew from class of 73, Pomona, but it's actually I've always I wanted to do Peace Corps when I was when I was in med school and at Pomona, and never got a chance because we couldn't afford to take that time off. But this is service too, and I love it because public health is service, and so you're able to use what what you've accumulated. I've been able to take that experience from my high school football coach, from what Pomona gave me, and give it back. So,
mm-hmm. What gives you the most sense of satisfaction?
Saving lives, there is no greater high than to save lives. And that's the one real endorphin rush of an ER doctor. But for every life you save, you've got four or five that you don't save. So that balances, and you've got to ride that out. But as a health officer, to make a difference, to make a difference in a community, preventing syphilis and we're in a big epidemic of congenital syphilis right now. Saving that one baby from getting congenital syphilis, which is dooming them for the rest of their lives. So it's a constant kind of endorphin rush.
I was going to ask you, what makes a really good day?
An ER, it's easy. A really good day is when you've seen all the patients, moved them through quickly, and saved a few lives. With public health, it takes a while. But, knowing that you've reached a group, getting the right policy through, instilling some trust in people, and making a difference in people's lives, I think that it's a great day when you do that.
What makes you optimistic for the future?
I think we've got great people. There are a lot of smart, good people who... who basically will do things. I really truly believe, regardless of political party, people still want to do the right thing. So I think in the long run, if we get the right people, the good thinkers with the right attitudes, we'll definitely move past all of this. So.
Well, Dr. Michael Sakura, this is a great way to end. Thank you so much for sharing with our SageCast audience today about some amazing work that you're doing to help our communities be healthier. Thank you.
We appreciate it and appreciate the opportunity.
And that's our show. Our thanks to Pomona alumnus, Dr. Michael Sakura, Public Health Officer for San Bernardino County.
And thanks to our audio engineer, Erica Tyron, and KSBC for hosting our conversations. Join us next time for another conversation about tackling the difficult.